From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Madeline Brand. Coming up, a mortgage crisis rekindles true love.
First, inflation is up. Business is sluggish. The markets are shaky. However you look at it, the economy is having troubles. So what's next? How about credit cards? People do tend to carry some pretty big debt on their plastic. Producer Kimin Sung talked with some shoppers in Santa Monica.
I started with about $15,000 and right now struggling with about $3,000.
What was the largest credit card purchase?
Car. We bought a Nissan. That's it, about $5,000, $6,000 gone there.
My credit card debt is like $11,000.
And what's the most expensive thing you've ever charged?
Recently, it was a plasma TV, 42-inch.
And how much did that cost?
$1,200, maybe?
I have about $600. I only use it for gas, and the way gas is, you know, driving all around. So I just use it for gas, honestly.
Those are voices of some credit card holders here in Southern California. That was Adam Moss and Kelvin Larkin and RT Agarwal.
So is a credit card crisis next? Ron Iannieri is the chief market strategist for an investor education company. It's called Options University.
What's going on is as inflation increases, more and more of us are spending more and more dollars on necessities. So what's happening is our disposable income is getting cut down and our necessity income is increasing. As our disposable income gets knocked down, we're going to look to replace that. And normally what happens is people turn to credit cards to replace that disposable income.
So is the danger that Americans will just stop paying their credit card bills and default?
That is exactly what the danger is, and that's exactly what we're seeing right now. We're seeing an increase in defaults on credit cards, but we're also seeing the highest level we've ever seen in terms of late payments. Most amount of people, biggest amount of dollars in terms of late payments, and that has been increasing for the last several months.
So if you default on your mortgage, you lose your house. What happens if you default on your credit card?
Well, if you default on your credit card, eventually they're going to ask for the entire balance to be paid immediately. That's what winds up happening. From there, you become a credit risk. So whether if you don't pay off that balance, the entire balance, immediately, it starts to show on your credit report. In the same way we're seeing a lot of banks and their credit ratings decrease, which makes it harder for them to borrow money, the same thing happens to individual people. As your credit risk increases, the likelihood and the chances of you being able to borrow money become much more unlikely. And in a situation and a time where we already have a problem with getting credit, it's going to make it real tough for a lot of people to get money.
So, Ron, broaden this out, if you would, and talk about how this would affect the larger economy, banks in particular. We've seen a number of them go under because of the housing crisis. Could the same thing happen because of a credit card crisis?
Well, I don't think necessarily that they hold as much credit card debt as they would hold mortgage debt. However, in a situation where they're already in trouble from mortgage debt, adding a credit card debt problem with these banks, a failure to collect there, could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. So it's more of a thing where I don't think that the actual credit card crisis itself is that destructive. But when you combine it with the mortgage crisis and the overall credit crisis, yeah, this could be the final blow to a lot of different banks.
Do you see any big banks getting into trouble over this?
Well, obviously the big issuers, when you're talking about Citigroup and you're talking about Bank of America, and a lot of these banks make good margin on credit cards. The Fed funds rate right now is 2%. Prime rate's a little above that, yet there's credit cards out there that are charging in 19 and 20%. So there's a really good margin on these credit cards, which produces a lot of profitability for the banks. If those profits are also chopped, along with everything else that's been chopped, a lot of these banks will feel a lot of pressure from it. It could easily be a major contributing factor to banks going under, which I do see coming up in the next several months.
Ron, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Ron Iannieri. He's chief market strategist at Options University.
When it comes to mortgages, the industry estimates there are going to be 1 million home foreclosures by the end of this year. Now, it's hard to understand a million stories, easier to get one. So here it is, Irwin and Inger Young, just barely hanging on to their house. The story from New Hampshire Public Radio's Dan Gornstein.
Irwin and Inger Young live in an 1876 New England farmhouse in Sandwich. In some ways, it's their dream home. It's near Irwin's job, where he makes about $50,000 a year managing a restaurant. Inger loves the spot. Beautiful views, space, a short walk to a perfect swimming hole on the cold river. When they bought it in 2002, they knew it would need some serious work. 6 years later, it still does. Insulation is exposed. The downstairs bathroom is missing a wall. When you look up in the kitchen, where the ceiling ought to be, you see the bottom of the Young's bathtub. In the spring of 2007, after 5 years of endless home repairs, Irwin says they just couldn't keep up with the expenses anymore.
March is when I started falling behind. Bills coming, you know, that she's telling me I have to pay this, and I made the same amount of money, but there were so many things going wrong. So by May, everything was in a turmoil.
The couple was arguing all the time.
So I don't know how it happens to married people. We got in one of those ruts where we could point out all the problems, but we couldn't come up with any solutions.
Irwin moved out. He found a place for $140 a week. But already tight on cash, the family couldn't afford that and their mortgage payment. By June, they were facing foreclosure. One day that month, Inger got a phone call.
She introduced herself as Yvette. She said she was from Houston Finance. We've helped a lot of people stay in their houses that are in your position.
Attorney Sarah Mattson, who's representing the Youngs, says groups like Houston Finance and Leasing are known as home mortgage rescuers.
The language that they use is, we can help you stay here in your home. We can help you save your house. We can help you stop this foreclosure. That's how they approach people.
We start talking about this. Wait a minute, we're going to lose everything we have.
Right.
If we don't...
She's come home.
If we don't come around.
Save the house.
We've got to smarten up. Stop it. You know, you've got to stop giving those people money for rent and get yourself home and take care of business. So we get back together, and we made two payments to Countrywide.
That move temporarily staved off the foreclosure. The Young say Houston, meanwhile, was telling them it could buy the mortgage from Countrywide for $88,000. That way, the Youngs could cut their mortgage almost in half. Irwin saw this as an opportunity to save the house and a real chance to get ahead.
Countrywide accepted the short sale for $88,000. And I was all happy because I told her payments are going to go down.
I was so happy. And I'm proud. We fixed this. We came through it again. One more time.
In October, the Youngs drove down to Houston's office in Manchester. The family made a day of it, bringing their two youngest sons along to celebrate. Attorney Sarah Mattson.
The Youngs' understanding is that Houston Finance is a lender or investor of sorts that's going to take over their mortgage, and the Youngs are going to make payments directly to Houston until they're able to refinance. That's what they think is going to happen.
But as soon as the Youngs walked in, something felt wrong. Yvette, the woman they had been talking to all these months, was waiting for them.
She said there's a glitch. She called it a glitch that we just found out about. You know, you're just going to have to lease it temporarily.
It's a classic bait and switch.
That's Elliot Berry, the Young's other attorney.
The Young's get no cash out of the proceeding whatsoever. They get their mortgage settled out with Countrywide and given a lease and option to repurchase.
Inger knew this was not the deal.
I kept telling myself it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And she could see that I was getting upset. And she, instead of trying to make it better, she made it worse. She said, if you don't sign them, they're going to foreclose.
Take it or leave it. If you don't do it, it's game over. House is foreclosed upon.
Inger couldn't imagine packing up their stuff in 2 days. She couldn't imagine leaving her home. Irwin had already signed the papers. So with Yvette's assurances, she went ahead.
The paperwork's going to come through. You're going to have your mortgage and everything's going to be fine.
Inger wasn't convinced. There was no celebrating on the ride home.
And after that, I called them constantly, this Yvette, constantly. Where's the paperwork? I wrote them letters.
Houston Finance and Leasing didn't respond to requests for comment. 30 days went by, 60 days went by. Finally, after 90 days, the Youngs went and checked. Their name was no longer on the deed. The property had been sold to a third party. And now, a new bank holds a new mortgage on the house the Youngs still live in.
We have no way of knowing what's going on with that loan, if it's getting paid, if it's behind, if it's going to have a foreclosure auction tomorrow. If that loan doesn't get paid, they're going to want this house.
Every day. Every day. Every day. I pray that I'll come home and find something on the door, you know. I try not to think about that. I try to have faith in God. This is wrong. And that justice will be done. What else can we do? We can't just leave. We have to try to fight for what's right.
What eats at Inger almost as much as being swindled out of the deed to her home is being deceived so completely by the woman she knew as Yvette.
Don't you worry. You're going to stay right there. Don't worry. Don't go ahead, plant your gardens. Do what you've got to do. And she lied. They just lied. They never intended for us to keep our home.
But attorney Elliot Berry says there may be a way for them to keep their home.
None of the disclosures, including the all-important right to rescind the sale, were provided in that means that the Youngs to this day may very well have the right to rescind the deal.
The last thing Inger wants to do is give Houston any credit for anything. But she says she's got to admit this foreclosure fiasco has helped her marriage some.
I think it did snap my husband around to prioritize. You know, that's what got us in it in the first place was his, you know, he wanted to throw the towel in and I didn't. Now he wants it. He wants to fight for the house. He wants to fix it. He wants to tinker. He wants to, you know, the goats and the chickens and the bird feeders and the, he wants to paint the kitchen. I'm just sorry it took jeopardizing it all to get there.
Well, actually, we want it more than ever now. I mean, there was a lot of problems with it, but now I want to fight to the end to keep it.
The Youngs' case is scheduled for next month. In the meantime, everything is on hold. Projects wait, half done. The Youngs unsure whether to invest in something that might soon be lost. But there's one thing they can't wait on, the cordwood they need to heat the house this winter. They say they'll buy it, not because they're optimistic, but because they don't know what else to do. For NPR News, I'm Dan Gorenstein in Concord, New Hampshire.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. We heard the first part of Madeline's interview with Jane Mayer yesterday. This is about Jane's new book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. We heard what was behind some of the most controversial decisions in the war on terror.
Today, we hear who was behind them. Jane Mayer says it was Vice President Dick Cheney, along with his then legal advisor, David Addington. He's a man she describes as the most important man in America that Americans have never heard of.
The two of them had long wished to restore the kind of nearly imperial powers of the presidency that were in the Nixon days. Cheney had been very upset during Watergate and particularly upset with the post-Watergate reforms that put a lot of curbs on presidential power. Because of Nixon's spying, they stopped presidents from being able to spy domestically. They passed the War Powers Act. There was the Freedom of Information Act, all kinds of things to try to put some more checks and balances on the president. And Cheney had been chafing at this for a very long time, so had Addington. So after 9/11, basically by calling the war on terrorism a war, they could give the president the powers of the commander-in-chief, and then they reinvented exactly what that meant by redefining the laws.
And what exactly did they want to redefine? What powers did they want to give the president?
Well, it's really quite incredible. We're still only now seeing some of these memos. Many of them have not come out still. I'm not a lawyer myself, but you can sort of read what Bruce Fein says. He's a Republican lawyer, and he says it sort of reminded him of, you know, Louis XIV or something. It was kind of like a secret legal empowerment going on in the back rooms of the Justice Department.
All run by David Addington and Vice President Cheney?
Well, there was a group of lawyers, a very small group of lawyers. They actually were kind of like a clique. They called themselves the War Council. David Addington was one of them. Jim Haynes, who was the lawyer at the Pentagon, was another. There were a couple people in the White House legal office, including Alberto Gonzalez, who was the legal counsel in the White House at the time. And they excluded very carefully anybody who would disagree with them. So many of the people who were most experts in things like the law of war, particularly the military, many of the people who knew most about international law, like interpreting treaties, such as the people at the State Department, those lawyers were cut out. They really didn't know what was happening. And so what I've been trying to do is piece all of this together, because I think the country's gotten bits of it, kind of like pieces of a puzzle, out of order. It's actually one great big incredible story. It's like an epic. It starts at 9/11 and it goes right on up through Guantanamo and the CIA dark prison sites and all the rest of the things that we're now sort of more familiar with than we wish we were.
So it all starts with this small clique, as you say, and it includes David Addington, Vice President Cheney, John Yoo at the Office of Legal Counsel, and a few others. And they basically get together and don't include, for example, the Attorney General at the time, John Ashcroft, nor do they include Colin Powell, the Secretary of State at the time, or Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor. And they all come up with these justifications for not abiding by the Geneva Conventions, of getting around the FISA law, of instituting these harsh interrogation techniques?
Well, basically, they come up with a theory that the president was really above the law. When it came to protecting the country, he didn't have to abide by laws that had been passed by Congress. So laws like the Convention Against Torture, they find ways to reinterpret and step outside of. And it winds up with a kind of a breathtaking break with America's tradition, which is very much the rule of law. This was really sort of putting the president above and outside all of that.
And where was the president on all this?
One of the funny things about this is that Cheney and the people around him were always arguing about expanding executive power in the name of the president. But the president actually is not that visible in a lot of these moves. From what I've been able to see, Cheney really was, in almost every case on national security, calling the shots. He and his old friend Rumsfeld, basically. And the president, you know, I talked to somebody who briefed him regularly who said, well, you know, he was kind of distracted. He said that they scheduled him in 5-minute increments, and so he really didn't have much time to focus on a lot of things, where, by contrast, Cheney was described as really drilling down and really getting all of the details. He was also described as somebody who really couldn't care less if nobody liked him. So he was undeterred by the need to be popular, and he just kind of pursued a very extreme agenda that I think, if it had been public, would not have been popular.
So these legal memos are drafted to explain in very dense legalese how to get around certain laws by the office in the Justice Department, the Office of Legal Counsel. And so then these legal memos, they translate into what?
Translate basically into, call it what you want, they translate into a complete green light to go and wage the war on terror in pretty much any way they think they need to do so. And they also translate into what Jack Goldsmith, who used to run the Office of Legal Counsel, called a golden shield or a get-out-of-jail-free card. The Justice Department is telling both the CIA and the military that many of the rules that restricted how you treat prisoners are no longer applicable. So what happens is the soldiers out in the field have the old rules taken away, the Geneva Convention rules, and really don't have anything new much to deal with. They're told they needed to try to treat prisoners humanely, but nobody really knows exactly what that means on any given day. So they kind of put the soldiers in a free fall. And the same thing with many of the CIA officers who were involved with interrogation. Suddenly, they're allowed to do things like waterboard detainees, where in the past, waterboarding was absolutely considered torture and considered a crime. Now, I don't want to try to give the impression that the CIA's program was just, you know, willy-nilly and that people were making it up as they were going along. Because one of the things that I discovered in working on this book was that it was very tightly controlled straight from the top over at the CIA. It was almost like, if you remember that childhood game, Mother May I, where you have to ask each time if you can take a step. They would have interrogators halfway around the world saying, can I slap the guy in the belly? Can I give him an extra hour of sleep deprivation? There was a constant traffic back and forth between the interrogators and the bosses in Langley, which means that should anyone ever be able to open up the books here, what they would be able to find is a true sort of line of accountability that goes right to the top of the government.
Jane Mayer of The New Yorker magazine. Our conversation continues tomorrow about her new book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals.
Many, many good people, most of the people who really clashed on the idea of torture, got driven out, and they took great expertise with them.
So far, the White House has not responded to Jane Mayer's book. We asked again today and again received no comment from them. This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. Coming up, Noah Adams in Iowa on helping farmers after the floods.
First, a news follow-up to the interview we just ran with reporter Jane Mayer on her new book, The Dark Side. It's about the Bush administration's anti-terrorism interrogation policies and whether or not they involve torture.
In Washington today, the House Judiciary Committee is taking testimony about that, and the star witness is former Attorney General John Ashcroft. Slate senior editor Dahlia Lithwick. Hi again, Dahlia. Give us background here. Where does this hearing on interrogation and accusations of torture fit in with the earlier ones?
Well, this is the fifth hearing, Alex, in a long series of hearings that the House Democrats have held. House Republicans say five is too many, seeking to, in effect, reconstruct the birth of this torture policy that Jane Mayer was just talking about, how it came to be that these, quote, alternative methods of interrogation suddenly became legal and kind of down the road turned into waterboarding and other significantly abusive techniques at Guantanamo. So really what congressional Democrats are trying to figure out is whether this series of secret memos that Jane described that redefined torture and then immunized the torturers, whether they were the first step in a logical causal chain that led to torture at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere.
So what are the specific questions that the committee has today for Mr. Ashcroft in this, Dahlia?
Well, remember, Ashcroft was the attorney general when these secret memos were authorized, when they came out. He was also the attorney general. It was on his watch that these memos were withdrawn by the new head of the Office of Legal Counsel, Jack Goldsmith, who said that they were poorly reasoned, they were bad lawyering. And so really, I think what the House Democrats wanted to hear today was Ashcroft saying, I withdrew the original memos because they were bad and they caused torture. That was certainly the hope. The hope was that they could really get him to explain that those first memos were horrific legal reasoning, and that's why he withdrew them.
And how does Mr. Ashcroft seem to be responding now?
Well, he is just so deft, Alex. First of all, he says, look, we withdrew the bad memos. Doesn't that in itself prove that the system worked? We self-corrected without any oversight. That's his first argument. And then he really, really kind of downplays how bad those first memos were. He talked today about how they were, quote, unnecessary discussions. They were, quote, overly broad, that there was just some bad language in there that needed to be corrected, repaired, and fixed. And so the new memos really sort of tweaked them a little bit, got out the worst of it, but they were did not change the interrogation policies. They did not, that the underlying policies that were approved in the initial memos or supported by the additional memos were still the interrogation policies that were still legal. In fact, he wouldn't say that waterboarding is illegal. So really, he just said, oh, the system works. We fixed what was wrong, and so clearly the system works. Here is a clip of him just explaining how these extreme memos, the initial memos, were really just not ever adhered to. Here's why he withdrew the memos.
One way to think about this is to imagine that a highway had a posted speed limit of 85 miles per hour, but the cars traveling upon it never moved faster than 65 miles per hour. Taking down the 85 mile per hour signs and putting up 65 mile per hour signs would not require a change in driving conduct. It would merely redefine the outer boundaries of what drivers would be said legally could be done. This is precisely what happened with the interrogation advice rendered by the department in 2002 and 2003.
I can't tell from that whether the former attorney general is backing away from what the administration has done or not.
He's really not. What he's in effect saying is everybody was driving 65 miles per hour all along. No laws were broken. Everything was okay. The memos were too extreme, but nobody ever broke any laws. It's important to remember that John Ashcroft is known to have said, quote, history will not remember this kindly. I mean, he, throughout his tenure at the AG's office, was taking strong positions internally and secretly against some of the excesses of the Bush administration. But the face he's presenting to the public today, Alex, is one in lockstep with what the administration did. He says lives were saved because what the administration did.
Slate senior editor Dahlia Lithwick on the testimony today of John Ashcroft before the House Judiciary Committee. Dahlia, thank you again.
It's always a pleasure, Alex.
From NPR News, this is Day to Day. On Wall Street today, investors are hoping to extend yesterday's stock market rally, and so far, not so bad. The Dow is up just a bit. The Standard & Poor's 500 index had its biggest gain yesterday since April. Marketplace's Amy Scott is here. And Amy, before we talk details about today, what was behind this big rally yesterday?
Well, Madeline, it had a lot to do with one bank, actually. Wells Fargo reported better than expected earnings for its second quarter and raised its quarterly dividend. Mind you, this was the bank's third quarter in a row of profit declines, thanks to credit-related losses. But investors saw this as a ray of hope for the whole banking industry, which has been so battered lately. And we saw the same thing this morning with JP Morgan Chase. It's a sign of just how bad things are when a 53% decline in profits gets investors excited. But again, these results were better than expected, and bank stocks rose again today.
So a few bank stocks, they have this big ripple effect on the rest of the market?
Yeah, partly because financial stocks carry a lot of weight in the S&P 500 index, so big gains in the stocks can lift the whole thing. I talked to Charles Roteblatt today. He's a market analyst with Zacks.com. He says investors have been really concerned about the banking sector because the health of the economy depends so much on the bank's ability to lend money.
Tighter credit standards make it more difficult for people to afford houses. It makes it more difficult for them to buy new cars. And as a result, it has implications for both the construction sector, the manufacturing sector, and also the auto sector.
And we'll be hearing from a few more big banks later today and tomorrow. Merrill Lynch is expected to report heavy loan losses after the market closes today. And Citigroup comes out with its earnings tomorrow. So we'll see if this trend continues.
Well, so far, so good today, right?
That's right. The market started out pretty strong. It's been a little up and down. But thanks to that news from JP Morgan Chase and some surprising housing news, the number of new home construction projects jumped by more than 9% last month. That's the biggest jump in more than 2 years. But as usual, you got to read the fine print. The gains were mostly because of a change in the building code here in New York City that spurred a wave of new apartment construction. Overall, construction was down. Also today, there was news that fewer people applied for jobless benefits last week than economists had expected. And some other news is weighing on the markets. Coca-Cola said today the weak economy hurt its results. Continental Airlines lost money last quarter, again, because of the weak economy and high fuel costs. So there's a lot of mixed news today.
Thank you, Amy. That's Amy Scott of Public Radio's Daily Business Show Marketplace. This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. In eastern Iowa, the rivers and creeks are back to more reasonable levels now. Flooding in June destroyed thousands of homes and buildings and bridges, and include this in the losses, $4 billion worth of corn and soybeans. NPR's Noah Adams spent Iowa days with a guy who drives around in a truck helping farmers who still do have crops growing. Here's Noah's piece about a man whose license plate reads Crop Doc.
The flood of 08. They'll be telling stories about it the same way they talk about the 93 flood. Jim Fawcett worked that one, too. He has 20 years on the job with Iowa State University. He's an agronomist, a crop specialist with the university's extension service. He's based in Iowa City, out at the county fairgrounds.
How many dogs are here, do you think?
I really don't know. This is the first time I've looked myself. I've just been hearing them from my office and haven't come to look. But it looks like quite a few.
It's a temporary home for the dogs because of the flooding. Jim Fawcett's been too busy with crop issues to go out back and take a look.
It's nice being across the hall from him because growing up on the farm and now not living on the farm, I still am on the farm by way of Jim.
That's Diana Colgan, a 4-H youth coordinator for Johnson County. Jim Fawcett has a Ph.D. in weeds. His master's is in oats. He has soil survey books for each of his 8 counties, chemical reference books, and he can always turn to his colleagues at the university.
Thank you. Your passcode has been accepted. At the tone, you will be the 6th caller in the conference.
On most Monday mornings, Jim Fawcett joins a teleconference from the Iowa State campus in Ames, 140 miles away.
Good morning. Why don't we go ahead and get started? We are filtering in slowly here in Agronomy Hall.
Mike Owen is running the meeting. His experts are ready, including a meteorologist with the upcoming ag weather.
Some of the warm air may come down off the Rockies into northwest Iowa as we approach the middle of July.
Among the field agronomists Mike Owen checks in with around the state, there is much talk about rainfall. 2008 has been wet and chilly, a dreadful year even without the floods.
Jim Fawcett.
We had some wind last Wednesday night, I believe it was, so some corn went down with that. Some of the corn is starting to look a little better, starting to have a better green color to it, but about every field there'll be areas that are gone or yellowing.
The teleconference is useful, but quickly as he can, Jim Fawcett is out getting his shoes muddy. He is, after all, a field agronomist, and he has the 8 counties to cover. He's worried. The price of corn is at an all-time high, but because of the weather, his farmers are having trouble growing it. Garth Gardeman turns off his tractor and walks Jim Fawcett over the crest of a hill.
I think this is the third time I've had you look at corn for me.
And this time, Gardeman has a swath of sick-looking corn up close to the fence line. He figures his neighbor farmers were spraying a chemical in a high wind.
These guys are so pushed to cover their acres.
Yeah. And especially this year, you just didn't have very many days to spray. So if it's dry enough, they're going to be in there and hope they get away with the windy days.
Jim Fawcett will write a letter about the wayward spray. He offers to call the farmers himself. Some money might change hands. There are more stops throughout the day. Fawcett sees ragweed and water hemp sprouting in a soybean field. The hemp hasn't been a problem since the 93 flood and rains. And he digs up a weak-looking bean plant for a diagnosis.
It's Rhizoctonia root rot. It causes a kind of a brick red coloration near where the soil line is.
To visit the farms and make the occasional trip to Iowa State and Ames, Jim Fawcett drives a Nissan 4x4. It's his own truck. The university pays the mileage.
Does it matter to a farmer what kind of vehicle the agronomist shows up in?
Well, the first year I was on the job, I didn't have a pickup. I had a Ford Probe, but the Probe wasn't the best car to be driving through fields in. It was pretty low to the ground, and I think maybe it does matter some to the farmer when you show up in a pickup. It looks like you're... You know more about farming than showing up in a car, but I really need the pickup for some of the things I do. Sometimes I have chemicals, pesticides that I really shouldn't have in a car. I need them in the back of the pickup.
Home, in time for hamburgers on the porch, Jim and his wife Kathleen live north of Iowa City, a house by a lake.
Hi, hello.
Kathleen.
Nice to meet you. How do you like Iowa so far?
Great.
Yeah? Yeah. Has it been hot?
Well, we've been in the truck most of the time.
And for me, it's the guest bedroom overnight. The next morning, Kathleen is out of the house before Jim starts breakfast. Both have careers helping people. Kathleen is a nurse. Jim is feeling the pain of a bad crop year, but that's just economics.
I don't know if I could stand the blood that she deals with, so this is a little more something I can deal with.
We decide to drop in on an extension service field day in an adjoining district. For the farmers gathered under an awning out in a cornfield, it's a bit of socializing. The lunch is free, and so is the advice. Here, Brian Lang is talking about no-till planting. He is fast and technical.
To just kind of sort out, okay, what have yields been doing for continuous corn compared to corn fallow beans, compared to corn beans. Down towards the bottom, we've got soybeans following 2 years of corn, soybeans following.
Our last stop on my visit, Jim Fawcett's old family farm outside Iowa City. This is where he grew up. This is where he hid in a basement from a tornado. His cousins run the place now, working hundreds of acres. It was his great-grandfather who built the house in 1896. It stands on a slight rise, sheltered by the old trees, a sycamore, a cottonwood.
Had a hop of crab that had gotten a little too big. My mom liked to come out and see when she, after she went to the retirement home. We had an ash tree on the other side of the house that my dad planted that got way too big, and so we had to take it down. But we're thinking we're going to replant some trees kind of in their memory. They're both gone now.
Jim Fawcett's sister, just now retiring from a city job, has been doing some work on the home place. He says she plans to move in and become quite a serious gardener.
That looks kind of like tobacco. What is that going on? I don't know my vegetables very well.
Why would your sister be growing tobacco?
I don't think it is, but I'm not sure what that is.
In the vegetable garden.
I recognize the weeds, but I don't recognize the garden plants.
Back when he was 13, he started having leg pains. He had a congenital spinal defect. There was an operation to fuse the spine, but he figured he'd never be able to develop the strength to become a farmer to do the lifting. However, he would be able to be a farm scientist. Noah Adams, NPR News.
You know, there's been a lot of grim financial news out lately. The latest, IndyMac, that big California bank, went under, and that's raised a lot of questions.
Here's one. What happens if I have my money in a money market account? Is that insured?
It is by the federal government, but a money market fund is not.
So do you have questions about bank failures, and what are you doing now? What are your ideas about keeping your money safe? Send them to us, your ideas and your questions. We'll have an expert answer them on the air. You can contact us at this link, npr.org, and put banks in the subject line. So go to npr.org, click on Contact Us, put banks in the subject line. We'll have more in a moment on Day to Day. Back now with Day to Day. Pop and classical music seem to have lots of prodigies, but it's rare when jazz discovers a teenage talent. Resident musician and critic David Waz has this review.
What if I told you that the future of jazz, which many have pronounced dead or dying in the last two decades, rested in the hands of a 16-year-old Korean-American saxophonist named Grace Kelly? Her name is as unlikely as her ungodly musical prowess at such a tender age. But her link to jazz royalty already makes her an heiress apparent to the throne. The Brookline, Massachusetts native has just released Gracefully, her fifth album as a bandleader. She began classical piano studies at the age of 6, but was hooked by the sound of the alto sax due to her mother's enduring love for the music of Stan Getz. There are those in the genetics camp who deny that musical talent is inborn, attributing success more to work ethic and environment than a fortuitous allele on gene 247. If determination and monomania are the criteria, Grace Kelly is well ahead of the curve. She's already completed the 4-year jazz studies certificate program at the New England Conservatory of Music. She's also appeared with and written an arrangement for the Boston Pops. If that isn't enough to at least grant her prodigy status, her major collaborator on the new CD is none other than alto sax legend Lee Konitz. units made his name in the 1950s with Miles Davis and Stan Kenton. Invited into Cameo on a few songs, he stayed long enough to work on the whole album, telling Grace, "I give you permission to play better than me." Their two-alto free improvisation entitled Buzzing Around is a true mind meld, and it's hard to say who's who at any given moment. Sensitivity to other musicians is another requisite in the jazz world, and that gift is shown off in her duet with guitarist Russell Malone on the ballad Just Friends. Her sure sense of swing is showcased on the upbeat Konitz composition, Thingin'. But to really get an idea of her alluring combination of modesty and confidence, go to YouTube and watch Miss Kelly sit in with Phil Woods, yet another alto sax immortal. She was only 14 at the time, but hearing her trade 8-bar phrases with Woods brought literal tears to my eyes. I've heard the future of jazz, and it is Grace Kelly.
The name of the CD is Gracefully. The musician is Grace Kelly. Our reviewer, David Was, is half of the musical duo Was Not Was. So Grace Kelly is the new John Coltrane?
We can always ask Youth Radio. Every Thursday, young people tell us the new trends to look out for. We call this series What's the New What? Here with this commentary is Youth Radio's Susanna Vuong.
What's the new what? I say
America's best dance crew
is the new American Idol.
I support that statement, and I hope everybody else grows to agree.
Well, of course she agrees with that statement. That's DJ Rashida. And she works on America's Best Dance Crew.
That's DJ Rashida supplying the beats. I'm Mario Lopez, and we are back on America's Best Dance Crew.
Like American Idol, it's a talent competition. On America's Best Dance Crew, it's groups of dancers from different cities that compete against each other. Some crews break dance, ballet, even. Some are dancing on skates, and they also use songs from popular artists such as Ne-Yo, Omarion, and Chris Brown. I'm a huge fan of the show, so of course I wanted to talk to my friends about it.
One of the differences between the two that I've noticed, it ain't no like super old people dancing, but it'd be heck of old people singing old boring music sometimes on American Idol.
When you watch America's Best Dance Crew, there's a lot more to look at. You're looking at people dance, hop, skip, jump, run all around the stage.
It's very different seeing someone trying to balance and do the moonwalk or do a flip. It's crazy to me. I find it very interesting and very unique.
And a lot of folks haven't seen that side as far as that culture of crews dancing, hip-hop, or doing their own kind of flavor. That's something new. It's a huge craze.
I do want to introduce everybody in America to Pat. He does a butterfly flip, which I think is pretty cool, and he drops into the splits.
I think Jozar and Ryan, y'all did flips like back to back.
I had a conversation with my cousin who lives in New York about our favorite crews. Of course, you know, all the crews he likes was from the East Coast. And, you know, we had a huge argument over who was the best crew.
It's like sports. Like, you know, you represent the West or you represent the East. On American Idol, I think a lot of people vote on the talent they see.
Yeah.
But on America's Best Dance Crew, talent isn't necessarily the only factor anymore.
We're Supreme Soul repping
the Bay Area.
We are Fresh Select from Philly.
America's Best Dance Crew really is the ultimate talent competition on TV. It's fast-paced. They choreograph acrobatic moves into their routines. Some use hats, jackets, and even masks as their props. It's like sports and art put together. American Idol still has a lot of viewers, but its ratings are the lowest in years. When the older generation asked me and my friends what we like to watch, it's definitely America's Best Dance Crew. So that's why I say America's Best Dance Crew is the new American Idol.
Youth Radio, Susanna Vuong. Check out past what's at npr.org/what.
What?
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 What's the new what?